podcasting from Nashville Guitar Store in the heart of Music City, USA. Bringing you inspiration, education, and behind-the-scenes stories from prominent guitarists and others influential in the music profession. Sharing tales of their history, discussing guitars, their gear, their work, what's on tap for the future, and delivering wisdom we'll all appreciate. Your host is Marcia Ware Wilder, nationally recognized radio personality, singer, actor, and author.
Well, today, I guess if I went through every single credit today's guest had, that would be the first half hour to hour. I mean, we would have to like go for like a 2-hour program here. But I will scratch the surface. Chris Rodriguez is in the studio today. Amy Grant, Michael W. Smith, Winona, Shania, Kenny Rogers, Kenny Loggins, Leanne Womack, Faith Hill, Keith Urban, Don Moen, Leanne Rimes, Russ Taff, Michael McDonald, Peter Cetera. The list goes on and on and on because this brother is talented. That's all I got to say about that. Yeah. So welcome to the show, my darling.
Thank you.
I appreciate you coming, taking time to come out. So we always like to go back to the very beginning here. Your genesis, as it were, was in the Bronx, mm-hmm. New York City. Mm-hmm. So tell me about that melting pot growing up there.
Well, my mom and dad, I like to call them West Side Story Puerto Ricans, right? So my dad came over in the late 40s, my mom in the mid 50s, mm-hmm. and so I'm the first child in my family that was actually born in the, you know, in the 50 states.
Okay.
And I grew up in the early 60s when my mom and my dad was kind of a doo-wop guy.
Okay.
He was really into doo-wop. He actually sang in a doo-wop group for a little while.
Okay.
But he worked in retail his whole life, mm-hmm. And then my mom was just a stellar mom. But there was always music in the house. Lots of we always had soundtracks to like plays. There was like West Side Story, Camelot,
yeah.
Kiss Me Kate,
yeah.
Zorba the Greek. Fiddler on the Roof.
Yeah.
So I grew up with a lot of that
yeah.
in the house, and really at the age of 5, I thought my path was going to be. I wanted to be Robert Goulet, and I wanted to be like a tenor mm-hmm. Broadway singer. And I knew tons of songs
yes.
just from all the albums that we had in house. But then we moved to another neighborhood when I started first grade, and a kid that I became best friends with, Steven Suglia,
uh-huh.
He had all these Beatles records, and that was it. At that point, I left the Broadway thing,
mm-hmm.
and that kind of set me on my path, actually. Once I got into that, it was about 3 years later before I really listened to anything else. Like it was
just the Beatles.
It was Beatles from age 6 to 9.
Wow!
And then quickly,
yeah,
it was. I'm probably exaggerating.
No, but I'm just saying.
But
yeah.
really, that was my
yeah.
universe.
Right.
That and baseball.
Yeah.
And then it was Jackson 5. And
I love it.
I mean, I went immediately from England to Detroit. And Marvin Gaye.
Because if you ask most British artists, they were in Detroit or Philly.
Yeah.
And mentally or emotionally anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
When I was like between the ages... Well, and still, to this current day. From the age of 6, I thought England was the promised land. It's the land of Robin Hood
yeah.
and castles and the Beatles.
Yeah. So who was your favorite Beatle?
Well, really interesting that I identified with George
mm-hmm.
because he was the guitarist.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I didn't take up guitar until age 10.
Okay.
But... he was always listed as the lead guitarist.
Yeah.
And he was also kind of quiet. I was pretty serious and quiet as a kid. So mm-hmm. I related to him, although the musically, mm-hmm. musically, the one I wanted to be was Paul.
Yeah. George was my favorite Beatle. I just always like to ask who, if you had a favorite Beatle, who would it be? That was mine. George was mine.
I think he was...
He was so... deep, soulful.
Yeah, also, like, I think he had the coolest clothes. Like, if you look back at, and I mean, they were all kind of stylish,
yeah.
but George was pretty, he's pretty well-dressed.
Yeah.
And also, when I look back at it retrospectively, he, you know, he was always like the, next to John and Paul, the guy that got put into the back room.
Yeah.
And he, you know, his songs, he was, relegated to, you know, one or two songs a record.
Yeah.
And he definitely changed all that, you know, later on.
Yeah, by the time they broke up, he had this arsenal, and it was it was cataclysmic.
But if you look back at it, his influence, like, he was the guy that got into spirituality and sitars, and that dude, essentially,
he was deep.
I think he changed the world. Like, the whole Eastern forsaking material values for spiritual, that... I mean, he almost kickstarted it all by himself.
Yeah.
Due to their influence.
Yeah.
So he's, I think he should get a fairer shake as far as influence.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
I'm with you because he truly, like I said, truly, he his music probably touched me more. I mean, I liked all. I mean, I am a huge Beatles fan, but as far as like when you look at them as a whole and them as individual artists, George's body of work just had, it spoke to me more. There was a depth to it that
he took them into the deeper thing that they I mean, they all were responsible and they were all they were all avant-garde and experimental and all that, but he kind of was the first hippie.
He was the dude.
Yeah,
he was. So you said age 10 is when you picked up guitar for the first time. Do you still have that guitar?
It is hanging up on a wall at my mom's across town from here.
I love that your mom is that kind of mom. This is my baby's first guitar. Now, wait. Now, back to family. Are you an only child? Do you have siblings?
I'm the oldest of four.
Oh, this okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So she's, I know she's proud of her boy.
Thank you.
Yeah, I know she is. I know she's. So tell me about that first guitar.
It was just a cheap classical guitar.
Yeah.
You know, it was a cheap classical guitar with, like, you know, black Stella strings, nylon.
And nylon, yeah.
I took guitar lessons for about a year and a half.
Okay.
And it was basically, you know, lead sheet music.
Right.
Where you're learning to read, Do You Know the Way to San Jose? Single line kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But sort of in, on my own time, I was like, there was a Mel Bay chord book. So I, on my own, would look at these chord diagrams and go, okay. So I learned, I sort of taught myself how to play rhythm.
Okay.
But the lessons were basically learning how to play.
Getting you through the door.
And playing the melodies. Yeah. You know? Sunny. Down, da, 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 da.
Yeah.
It was all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But what I really wanted to do was to be able to sing and accompany myself, like, you know.
Can you remember the first song you ever wrote? Do you remember it? What are the odds I could get you to, like, give us a little, like, just pick a guitar in the room and give us a sample? I mean, like, seriously, because while you're tuning, I can ask you other questions, but you can't have Chris Rodriguez in the studio without getting a little of that nice little magic.
I wanna smile and be with you. I wanna be happy and be with you.
And then I forgot. First goes.
Oh, look out now!
It's not bad for a 10-year-old kid.
Not bad for a 10-year-old kid at all, because that was like those were Beatle chords.
Yeah,
those are like nice.
I wanna smile and be with you.
Aww.
I wanna be happy and be with you. What was the third line? You know,
that's so awesome.
It's not bad.
That's it not bad for attention. So who was she?
Oh.
she was like a figment of my imagination.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, because I was 10, so I wasn't exactly dating yet.
Of course not. No crushes, though.
Oh, it was crushes left and right. I'm actually pretty sure that I wrote that for, like, I don't know, it's like my fourth cousin or something in Puerto Rico. You always end up falling in love with somebody in your family.
Yeah, right. You just
that you can never have.
You just don't talk about it after a certain age. Like, okay, I just don't. I'm blocking that. So, okay, so New York was a great time for you, and then Miami. How did that? What was the transition there?
So one day, and like New York was my life. Like, you know, I just.
Yeah.
It was all about music, and the New York Mets mm-hmm. was my team because they were they had won the World Series. And then I'm 13, and my dad goes, "Hey, we're moving to Miami in 2 weeks."
Oh, snap.
It was like the carpet got pulled from under me. I was like, what? You know, you're taking me away from my universe?
Mm-hmm.
It's the greatest thing that ever happened.
Really? How come?
Because I got down to Miami, and it was like a band on every corner. Like, I got into a band my second day at school there, mm-hmm. you know. And I met my best friends in high school all there. Mm-hmm. And we're all still really tight to this day.
Awesome.
So, Miami became...
Are they still down there?
Some are down there, and mm-hmm. some... Like, my best pal, who was the drummer in our band... He now lives in Atlanta, but it was, you know, the movie Almost Famous.
Yes.
Living in Miami was like that.
Okay.
And
it's actually one of my favorite movies.
It's one of the greatest. It's maybe my favorite music movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And but there was a band on every corner. This is basically, you know. Right around the time when the Doobie Brothers are really becoming huge stars.
Yeah.
And Allman Brothers and Grand Funks were an American band. And lo and behold, all this music was being recorded two blocks from where we moved.
Wow.
At Criteria Studios.
Wow, okay.
We ended up living in a duplex two blocks from Criteria. And I was very aware as a 13, 14-year-old that there was like historic records being made. You know,
that's cool.
1,000 yards away.
Yeah.
And because I would buy these records and read all the liner notes, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
Word for word.
Yep.
So, you know, I could see that.
How I discovered you, because I am a credit reading geek.
Yeah, I'm a liner notes person.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
Which I actually saw a Facebook post this morning from some studio musicians about the lack of liner note stuff happening now, which is really weird to me. We go to Miami, and that's it. I'm in a band. We cut grass to make money, to mm-hmm. buy amplifiers, to buy PA, to buy... microphones.
Mm-hmm.
We rehearse in the garage of my drummer's house, and we start out as a trio. Within a year and a half, we have a horn section, and we're like a 7-piece band,
mm-hmm.
playing Chicago and Earth, Wind, and Fire, also playing Led Zeppelin, also playing Bee Gees.
Yeah,
like we were genre-less.
Yes. Whatever sounded good, whatever felt good to play.
And at 16, I owned a talk box because Frampton.
I was just going to say you wanted to be free, yeah.
Or Joe Walsh.
Okay.
And I had one made for me,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't actually a floor box. It looked like a wine sack, and the driver was in this wine sack looking thing that you put over your shoulder. And the plastic tubing would connect to the microphone, and you couldn't move from your mic the whole set, because now it's a floor box. But back then, I had the idea. And I was making $100-$150 every weekend for a little kid.
Not too shabby.
Most of the time you kick that back into the band, so you're buying new and better gear,
yeah,
uniforms. And
how important was the gear to you back then? Did you feel like bigger, like, okay, for example, a friend of mine used to sell sound equipment, and one of his co-workers was trying to get this guy to buy just this wall of stuff, and it just had all these flashing lights. And he's like, I don't know if I need all this. And the guy said to the customer, come on, man, chicks dig the lights. Now you want to have all these lights because the chicks dig. So when you were like getting all this equipment, did you just want good sound, or did you want to have, like, you wanted to look like a rock star? What was your thought?
We wanted it all.
Yeah.
You know, like, but then again, the gear that I had was so, you know, primitive compared to what's available now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a PV Musician amp,
mm-hmm,
which had, it was a pretty big, bulky amp. It was a stack, you know, it was about the size of a Marshall stack,
yeah,
with a separate head. So, you know, you had to have speaker cable to connect the,
yeah,
head.
Yeah.
And I had a wah-wah. I maybe had a phase shifter,
okay,
an MXR phase shifter, and this thing called a Fender Blender, which was like solid state overdrive.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
And later on, I got a talk box.
Okay.
But, you know, the most freaky effect that you could get was phasing.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm,
when I was, that was it. I mean, there were certainly lots of effects starting to happen, but they were beyond my, you know, wallet,
yeah,
at that point. But I had, you know, I had a 1974 Stratocaster that my dad bought me. And when I realize now what he probably paid $400 or $500 for it back,
mm-hmm,
then,
mm-hmm,
which was like
massive,
man,
yeah,
a lot of money,
yeah,
for my dad. And it was a great guitar. It pretty much took me into my first, second year of college.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I would hope so.
So I had a good guitar.
Right.
And it was sort of a natural wood finish with a rosewood neck, big, large, oversized headstock.
Yeah.
That very 70s Strat.
Yeah.
But that took me, that guitar, that was it. It wasn't until I went to college and kind of got into jazz that I got a different guitar.
Yeah. Was college in Nashville, or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Then, yeah, so that's the Miami saga. I was there.
So we got New York, we got,
yeah,
Miami, now bouncing up to Nashville.
Yeah, and then right in the middle of my senior year, Dad goes, well, guess what? We're moving to Nashville.
Oh, snap.
And, so,
I love your dad.
Yeah.
Your dad's awesome.
Well, upwardly mobile.
Yes.
So I stayed and lived with the keyboard player in my band and his family.
Okay.
So that I could finish out my senior year. And so they moved here,
mm-hmm,
in January of 78, here in Nashville. And I stayed there for 5 months. Like, the last 5 months of my high school year.
Wow.
I was basically with a step family.
Mm-hmm.
I was working. Besides the band, I had a job as a roast beef carver at Morrison's Cafeteria.
Oh, Morrison's Cafeteria. Wow.
I was driving. I was very independent when you think about it. Not having, I'm very close family, so all of a sudden I don't have my mom and dad around every day. It was,
yeah,
like, this is amazing, the amount of freedom I have here.
Yeah.
It's also extremely dangerous.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
But then they came back down for graduation,
mm-hmm,
and then we all hopped back in the car and drove back to Tennessee.
Wow.
And then I got here basically as I was starting college.
Did you go to Belmont?
Not at first. I went to George Peabody College for Teachers.
Okay.
Which eventually, so in the middle of my freshman year, they merged with Vanderbilt.
Oh, okay.
And so the following year, my tuition was kind of quadruple.
Mm-hmm.
So George Peabody eventually became Blair School of Music.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But that was a very amazing year because I didn't know how to read music, and I was a music major.
Okay.
I mean, I knew how to read chords.
Right.
And but I didn't know the inner. So I became a classical guitar major. Like,
wow.
Without any previous experience. And within 3 months, I'm playing, you know, Villa-Lobos,
yes,
and Bach etudes, yeah, and, you know, Fernando Soar, and studying Julian Bream and Christopher Parkening.
Mm-hmm.
crash course from Stratocaster mm-hmm. rock guy mm-hmm. who, you know, all I wanted to be was Jeff Beck.
Yeah.
And then now I'm like reading.
Yeah.
And so, but what was cool is like I was already a player.
Yeah.
So basically I was just learning the names of things that I kind of maybe already knew.
Yeah.
Just didn't know what to call them.
Yeah.
And then sort of learning the mathematics of reading and subdivisions and. And then, so they merged with Vanderbilt, so that was when I decided to go across the street and try Belmont.
Literally across the street, yeah. That is so great.
And which ended up to be pretty fortuitous because yeah. I could major in electric guitar at Belmont, mm-hmm. and I could also book studio time because they had a studio.
Mm-hmm.
And
you get spoiled real quick.
Yeah, and I was at Belmont... yeah, and graduated from there.
Yeah, I had a buddy who I used to teach with. I taught voice, and he taught classical guitar, and I would call him Christopher, and he'd call me Kathy, as in Kathleen Battle, because that was my introduction to classical guitar, was Christopher Parkening and Kathleen Battle, because when I went to college, I went to Anderson in Indiana,
yeah.
and so they were all wow. about legit music, and forget my gospel stuff, forget, you know, I you know, it was like, it's all about, you know, art music and the education you get that my the thing I love, I guess the point I'm making is the thing I love about being able to learn that kind of music, and I want to know if it's the same for a guitarist, is my voice teacher said, look, you've got a bungalow and a mansion. They are very different buildings, but they're built pretty much the same way. Hammer, nails, mortar, you know, cement. I want to give you tools. I'm not going to tell you need to be in a mansion or you need to be here. I want to give you the tools to build whatever you want. And wow. I feel like that gave me, as a vocalist, who a love for music all across the board, but also it saved my voice.
Mm-hmm.
At 52, I feel like I'm singing stronger than I was at 22. Mm-hmm. And because of the stuff that so what your education at Belmont, or actually your education up to that point, do you feel as though even learning the classical stuff, do you feel like that kind of strengthened your technique?
Totally.
Yeah.
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 I mean, Belmont, I can't even stress how important mm-hmm. and how good it was for me to be there.
Mm-hmm.
If I could just fast forward, I mean, in 2 months, I'm going to be performing with the big band under the direction of Jeff Kirk, who's the dean of the School of Music.
Wow.
And one of my songs is being arranged for like 25 pieces.
Very cool.
And then we're doing a couple of Pat Metheny charts that are like really pretty demanding.
Yeah.
So like it's sort of like my first big foray, I think, back into academia since mm-hmm. going to school there. But like Belmont shaped me big time.
Mm-hmm.
And I met a lot of people that I still work with day in and day out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were just puppies then.
Yeah.
But, I mean, like my first day at school, I met Dan Huff, Gordon Kennedy, Gary Lunn.
Slackers, what have they done?
Yeah. And we all still, you know,
yeah.
we all yeah. still work together.
Y'all are all, yeah.
And, you know, I met a lot of important lifetime, you know, friendships and colleagues,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I had and still do, have a great guitar professor, John Pell, who's mm-hmm. now a very dear friend. I mean, we were friends in the beginning, even though it was teacher-student.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me good things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was like, I remember early on, he looked at me at a guitar lesson, and he's like, I'm not worried about you as a player.
Yeah.
You're going to make it.
Mm-hmm.
Which kind of blew my mind, like, for a teacher to say, mm-hmm. you're going to make it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I was like, well, yeah, I am.
Yeah.
You know? And... But his deal was, and this is echoing what you just said, I'm just going to give you a bunch of tools mm-hmm. to keep you working.
Yeah.
You know, so you're going to learn harmony, you're going to learn theory, you're going to, and do you have a tuxedo? Go buy you a tuxedo.
I love
because
it. Yeah.
There's some gigs I can't do anymore,
mm-hmm.
these casuals, and, but, you know, let's go get your feet wet. And so I bought a tux, and he started subbing out gigs mm-hmm. to me, you know.
That's awesome.
The kind of thing where you, on the first set, are playing Satin Doll and,
mm-hmm.
and Misty, and, you know, the second set, you're playing Long Train Running or something.
Love it.
You know.
That is so cool.
Yeah, so not only did I get an education at school, but I also got schooled out on the street.
Yeah, school hard knocks.
Playing military bases in Clarksville and that kind of stuff. Yeah, you know.
I thought I turned that down. Gotta love that. So, did you get your first break professionally while you were still a student, or did that happen?
Simultaneously while I was going to Belmont, I started working at Opryland, and I played in shows there every summer for about 4 years. It's weird because I was working on one of the rides as I was working on the Sky Ride.
Okay.
And my very good friend to this day, Gene Miller, was leaving the rock show to join Barbara Mandrell, move out to L.A. and start doing her TV show.
Okay.
So he was leaving, and they were auditioning guitar players, and I literally went over there in my uniform on a break from working on the Sky Ride.
Gotcha.
And I think I played Ride Like the Wind by Christopher Cross. And that was it. Okay. I got the gig.
All right.
So that was a big deal because I basically left, you know, the minimum wage job for, like, the best paying musician job in the park.
Wow.
You know,
yeah.
With the whopping $300 a week, which was like a fortune. And and playing music.
Yeah.
And that kind of, from that point on, I was employable in this town. And,
what was your first tour?
First tour, thank you, Dan Huff, was Michael W. Smith.
Okay.
And who was needing a guitarist for his first solo tour.
I remember that tour. I probably saw you on that tour.
Yeah, because you live in Ohio.
I grew up in Ohio. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We definitely played.
Oh, you played
five towns.
Oh, we our youth group used to go. We'd pack up the van if Smitty was playing in Veterans Memorial. I think that's where we saw. And I think he was one time we saw him with Amy. Then we saw him solo. That's just we just kind of follow. We were nerds. We followed. That was my first. Yeah.
You know, big. You know, get on a bus and go do 100 shows.
Yeah.
And I was 98% unfamiliar with what he did. You know, I didn't know any of his music. I'd heard of Amy Grant. I knew a couple of Amy Grant songs, and they were managed by the same management team.
Right.
But Michael W., that was my, you know, my first real pro experience, and it was because of Dan's recommendation. And then we go on the road, and it was like these, you know, state-of-the-art buses, and we had Claire Brothers PA, and Claire Brothers techs on the road, and it was super high end and super pro.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, what was your first mainstream gig? Do you remember? I mean,
well, so
because like I said, the way I got acquainted with your name was reading the liner notes, tons of Christian albums, and so you and Dan and Gary and all those guys just you kind of moved in these CCM circles. But when did you kind of break out of that? And
well, you know, Amy, because I did two tours with Michael W., I ended up and because they're all in the same family of artists and management, I eventually did two tours with Amy Grant, and on that second tour, Heart in Motion, she became one of the top five female pop artists in the country, or in the world, you know. And then Michael W. ended up having a couple of hits.
That's true.
But real, you know, if you're looking outside the contemporary Christian label, the first one was Kenny Loggins.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to get to the good stuff. We're going to talk about gear, how to travel with it, how much you really need on stage, and what to do when your guitar gets waterlogged. Yes, you heard me. Waterlogged. And believe it or not, it's not as complicated as you think. All that plus another round of Take Your Pick coming up in the second half of our conversation with the great Chris Rodriguez. I'm Marcia Wilder, and you are at NashvilleGuitarStore.com.
At NashvilleGuitarStore.com, paying full price for guitars is a thing of the past. Like dial-up internet. You'll find Epiphone, Fender, Gretsch, Ibanez, Taylor, and lots more. What you won't find is the big box store prices. Get yourself a killer guitar at a fraction of the retail price at NashvilleGuitarStore.com.
NashvilleGuitarStore.com.
Taking you all the way back to 1999, the album is Beggar's Paradise, one of my favorite songs on this CD. Chris Rodriguez and The Valley Road. Welcome back to part two of our conversation with him here at NashvilleGuitarStore.com. Now, Chris, you divide your time between so many different kinds of artists on the road. So do you keep the gear set up pretty basic, or do you tend to evolve with each artist you share the stage with? Or just actually, are you evolving just as an artist in general?
Always evolving.
Yeah.
I mean, currently, because I play for Peter Cetera, everything we do is fly dates.
Right.
So I've got a small pedal board and a SKB canvas bag. It goes in my luggage with my Levi's.
You know? Excellent.
So, and then my bigger, more elaborate rigs are here at home for in-town use.
Mm-hmm.
But unless I got the last time I had an elaborate rig on the road was about 5 years ago when I was out with Kelly Clarkson,
mm-hmm.
which was a bus tour.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're on the $1 million bus, and there's a tech,
yeah.
and I just show up at soundcheck at 3:30, and all my stuff's set up.
Yeah,
and
that's a nice.
But the way we do it now, it's like, you know, I'm just kind of responsible for my own thing, so I want the best tone and a small package for what I'm doing now.
Mm-hmm.
With Kelly, the last time I had a big bus tour, I had probably the most elaborate rig I've ever had, which was I had a pedal board built where it would go stereo out to 2 50-watt stacks.
Okay.
So anytime I needed imaging or ping pong delays or anything that required a left and right, I could route my signal to those two heads going to two cabinets. Every chorus of the song required power cords, so then I would hit a radial box that would all of a sudden route my signal mono to a Marshall head.
Oh, cool.
To a boogie cab bone dry.
Mm-hmm.
And that was crunch.
Okay.
And so, you know, it's the whole setup of like stereo for wet signal and then a dry mono
mm-hmm.
thing, which usually ended up being hit mm-hmm. on the chorus mm-hmm. of every song. And it worked perfectly every night. It was a great rig. And I'd have to be back on some sort of arena tour to ever probably do anything that elaborate, because you just don't fly around with that kind of gear.
Right, absolutely, you know? Absolutely.
These days, I have two guitars in a double gig bag that goes over my shoulder,
yeah.
and I get on the plane with that.
That's beautiful.
My pedal board's in my luggage,
mm-hmm.
and backline is rented every night.
Right.
So I get a Fender Deluxe.
Oh, great.
Every night.
Okay.
Which has now become sort of my favorite show up at a gig and play
mm-hmm.
amp. It's just a good basic slate.
Mm-hmm.
It's very pedal friendly,
mm-hmm.
And that's
yeah, we had Will McFarlane in here a couple of days ago, and I know you guys are pretty
yeah.
tight, and he said something about a wah-wah pedal, and he just said, wah-wah, because you just never know.
That's, yeah.
And I said, you just need to put a pedal, you just need to post that on social media, just a wah-wah pedal, and just because you just never know. You never know when you're going to need one.
Yeah.
You just don't. But is there any kind of new technology that you're into or embracing or getting hip to, or do you kind of keep old school?
Well, I keep it old school just because time doesn't really permit. I'd love to get into the Kemper. I'm so late to the show there. I mean,
mm-hmm.
that's been around for several years, but I never got that. And then my buddy Dave Cleveland, he's been into this thing called Positive Grid, and which I really like the idea of that, mm-hmm. you know, with a laptop, and you can really kind of, seems very modular. You can, we did a session together about a month ago, and I was the assigned acoustic guy on that session, but
yeah.
every chance I could, I'd go back out to the floor to hear what he was doing, and
yeah.
it sounded amazing, and yeah. I'm like, there's not a real piece of gear here, you know, it's all software.
Oh, cool.
He mixed it in with a few hardware pedals
right,
on the
right.
floor,
yeah.
but essentially the main tone generating stuff was, he was manipulating on an iPad, which blows my mind. And it was very, the thing is, it sounded amazing.
Yeah.
That's,
so you've played for so many amazing artists and played with, you know, you've done your solo stuff. But as far as like, because I am still a huge fan of Beggar's Paradise. That's going to be etched in my memory forever. And if you don't know that album, look it up. Google, kids, Google. You got, thank God for the Googles and the internets, because I'm telling you right now, it reconnected me with that project. But I guess the question I want to ask is your personal technique. How much of your flavor can you infuse into, like you said, you've played for Kelly Clarkson, then you're touring with Peter Cetera. How much of your personal self can you bring to a gig, no matter what it is?
I bring a lot mm-hmm. of my own, you know, take. I mean, I'm also, I'll put it into pragmatic terms. With Peter Cetera,
mm-hmm.
I'm basically trying to ape Terry Kath, who's the
okay,
original
yep.
guitar player
mm-hmm.
of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
But then that's for all the 70s stuff, for the 1980s Chicago hits and Peter's solo stuff. I'm really chasing Mike Landau, Steve Lukather, Chris Pinnock.
Yeah.
So, like, I guess what I'm trying to say is there's about 30, 40 years of guitar history there that I'm having to cover a lot of ground. So I'm respectful of the people that I'm emulating,
mm-hmm.
but it's not like I learn every single solo note for note.
Okay.
There's absolutely written parts. Well, nothing's written, but like, There are lines that you got to play, like mm-hmm. when we do "Glory of Love," "Karate Kid."
Mm-hmm.
When we do. When I go. Those are parts
yeah.
that got to be played.
Yeah.
They're really strong
yes.
hooks in the song.
Yes, and they have to be there.
So, and they, yeah. you know, there's certain thematic lines
right.
that you play. But when it comes to solos, I pretty much, I can drift
mm-hmm.
and do my own thing.
Yeah. Because I know there's certain artists that kind of want their singers to sing everything the way it is on the album. They want their players to play it like it is on the album. But did you ever run into that kind of a scenario where you felt really constrained?
Yeah, and that's whatever the artist needs. It's
yeah,
like,
that's true.
The answer to all their questions is yes. Whatever
right,
you need,
right?
You know,
right.
I'm not writing the check.
Yeah,
you know? I'll do whatever's required of me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was with Keith Urban, there was a lot of freedom.
Yeah.
That was another gig where, you know, I had 5 years with him. There were lines that you needed to play.
Mm-hmm.
And that were the themes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those
yeah.
are the hooks.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, but when it came down to solos, go for it.
Yeah.
You know, and also he didn't want a stoic band, you know. I came in with like, I'm a studio guy. I'm going to play every 16th note tight. And he didn't really care about that.
Yeah.
He's like, I expect you to play tight. That's why I hired you.
Right.
Now go be a rock star.
Yeah.
You know. Try
and
to out-rock
you were like
me.
The first rock star on banjo. I was like, when you played with Urban, that was what stuck out in my mind,
yeah.
that you rocked the banjo.
Right.
And well, that was pretty amazing.
Mark Hill, who's an amazing bassist, became essentially a band of Keith's got let go, and then he hired Mark Hill to be the band leader and go get him a new band.
Gotcha.
And that's how I got the gig, with no audition.
Wow.
So Mark calls me and he goes, hey, there's something really huge about to happen. I can't even tell you who the artist's name is. But
yeah,
things are about to break wide open and they're looking for a guitarist / vocalist. Are you interested? And I'm like, and I started poking around for hints. He's like, Mark's like, well, this guy's, he's a really good player. He's a really good singer. And I'm like, well, tell Keith Urban's hello for me. Like, I figured it out right away. And of course, he can't answer the question
because
everything was sort of, they had to keep it hush hush. But, and then he goes, oh, and do you play banjo? And I, of course, I lied. And I said, yeah. I'm a whiz.
Yeah.
So as soon as we got off the phone, I went to Corner Music and bought a banjo.
Yeah.
Because I knew that I would be able to use Keith's $2,000 D-ring on the gig, but I didn't want to wait till day one of rehearsal, which was going to be a month later, to show up and try to figure out how to play banjo, which is essentially strung up.
A six-string banjo is strung up
like a guitar.
Okay.
But you have to approach it differently, you know. Like,
what is the difference? What is the approach?
Well, you got to double up on your right hand. You know, it's sort of like to play banjo rolls on a six-string banjo, to emulate what a real banjo does.
Right.
Your right hand just has to get busier.
So you played the banjo, not the ganjo. You weren't like...
No, I played the ganjo.
Oh, you played the ganjo.
I played the six string.
Okay, gotcha.
And every time you hear that on Keith's records, you're not hearing a traditional banjo. You're hearing a six string banjo.
Because to the average layman, they probably wouldn't have known the difference.
Yeah, but most people in town
who
are players would know.
Yeah.
You know,
even still, it gives you just enough of what that sound requires.
But if there's anybody who can make it sound like real, it's Keith.
Yeah.
You know, he's just got very gifted hands.
Yes, he
really
does.
Really gifted right hand.
He's a player's player.
He really is.
He's a player. He and Paisley and Steve Warner, I think of them as players.
Pretty much.
They're players, players.
Well, I think him and Brad are basically what Steve Warner and Vince were in the 90s.
Yes.
They're
absolutely.
Like, of the last 15, 20 years, Brad and Keith are like, you know, and you don't really see too many virtuosos become superstars, you know. That doesn't happen often. I mean, when I was a kid, it would have been Glenn Campbell, you know. And then in the 90s, it was, in the 80s and 90s, it was people like Ricky Skaggs and then Vince, Steve Warner. And then in the 2000s, it was Brad and Keith.
Yeah. You're right. And that's about all my mind can
later
conjure
on,
up.
Well, Hunter Hayes, you know, there are guys that kind of came up that became like really amazing virtuoso players that became stars, but it just doesn't happen often.
No, it really doesn't. And and that's actually kind of a good thing, because if it were easy, everybody could do it, and then it's not as special. So you've got your little pantheon of great, you know, virtuoso players. It's awesome. What guitar do you use to write when you're in writing mode?
I'm all over it. I bought a 53 Gibson 175 about 7-8 months ago. And I've been writing a lot of jazz songs on it. So when I go into that world, I'm pretty much sit on that guitar. Otherwise, I have a Martin D18. That is, it's not an old one. I bought it at Guitar Center 4 or 5 years ago. But if I want to write, I pick that up.
What makes a good writing guitar? I mean, what makes that great for writing? Or is it just a personal preference?
I don't know. I got a Gibson J50, which is essentially J45, that has a different feel. Like the Martin feels, it's slightly more audiophile. The J50 feels like a songwriter kind of strummer.
Okay,
you know, like if I want to do something a little more complex technically, mm-hmm. I'll probably jump for the D18. If I want to strum, mm-hmm. I tend to go for the J50.
Gotcha.
So, but each guitar has a different thing. Mm-hmm. I bought at a guitar show in Dallas, I got a Takamine 000. I have a Takamine 12 string. These are from the mid 70s when Takamine was getting sued by Martin because their guitars were such great copies.
Oh, okay.
So it's essentially a Martin guitar with tone woods, and mm-hmm. the build quality is amazing.
Yeah. So are those worth a lot now? Did they have to discontinue those because of the...
Well, I don't know that they've gone up in value all that much because... well, I don't want to get in trouble.
Okay.
But they're... For those who know, they're sort of the bargain of the century. Mm-hmm. And the 000 is one of my favorite guitars. I think I paid $400 for it.
Okay.
It's... It currently resides with my daughter, who's quite a player herself.
Okay. How old is she?
She's 22, mm-hmm. and she's an amazing guitar player.
That's very cool.
Like, no pick, acoustic, great.
We got to get her in here. I have no female representation on this show so far. We need some chick guitar players.
Yeah.
Yes, we
Nikki
do.
Nikki Rodriguez is something.
So, girls with guitars, that's a very important thing.
No pick. Cool tunings. Mm-hmm. It's like almost like a current Joni Mitchell-esque kind of technique, mm-hmm. and really great singing, and just she's her favorite musician's Paul McCartney. So I've taught her well.
Yeah, you have indeed. Yeah. So it sounds to me like your guitar arsenal is pretty massive. If you could think of one guitar that could tell a really cool story, mm-hmm. what would it be?
It would have to be my gold topped Les Paul Deluxe that I got in 2004 when I first got the Keith Urban gig. Mm-hmm. Within a week of getting the gig and it became public, Gibson called me. What do you want? We want to make you something. What do you want?
Wow.
And I was like, I want a gold top deluxe. I want a gold top deluxe because my one of my best pals, who's no longer with us, Will Owsley, mm-hmm. had a late 60s gold top deluxe. And I just loved the guitar. Mm-hmm. Thought it sounded great. Perfect guitar. Mm-hmm. And also, I knew that I'd be able to use it a lot because Keith was starting to transition out of just Telecasters and Fenders into a Gibson-y kind of sound. So I knew that mm-hmm. it would be the perfect guitar for the gig.
Yeah.
And then it was my main guitar.
Okay.
And still is. Mm-hmm. Probably the one I play the most day in and day out. It's got mini humbuckers, so it's got the... It's got the power of a Les Paul, yet it still has this sort of like quasi single coilish. Mm-hmm. It's not PAFs. I mean, it is a mini humbucker, so it's still a humbucker, but it still has a bit of that sparkle on mm-hmm. the top end, where it really becomes one of the most significant, if not the most significant, guitar in my collection. It was in the Nashville flood of 2010.
Wow!
And I had. Was on the road at that time with Leanne Rimes, so all my gear was in her locker at soundcheck, and essentially all my stuff was underwater.
Yeah. Soundcheck, a lot of folks lost a lot of stuff.
So all this gear got moved out of soundcheck and over to Trinity Lane, where they set up basically a musical gear graveyard. And Joe Glazer was there with some of the guys from his shop, mm-hmm. and they were just doing triage.
Wow.
They were going, well, this one's a goner.
Yeah.
This one has a chance.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. That's, yeah.
And you'd walk around and there'd be like 40 Hammond B3s.
Wow.
Totally
just, you know, trashed
all together in one little section. Then you go, and the next 100 yards is just acoustic guitars that were trashed.
Yeah.
And then amps, you name it. So I bring them. So the Les Paul swelled because of all the water.
Right.
The wood basically swelled a good quarter inch.
Yeah.
So Joe goes, put that guitar in a trash bag with rice.
Really?
Go get you about 20, 30 pounds of rice and come see me in 3 or 4 months.
Wow.
And lo and behold, the rice absorbed all the extra moisture. I probably changed the rice out every month for about 4 months. And the swelling went down. The neck stayed true. The frets never popped out. That was where I thought I had a chance, because the neck was fine,
even after
the flood.
Okay.
It was the body that got messed up.
Yeah.
And it...
So you just changed the rice out. It's in that trash bag.
Yeah, it absorbed. This happens when you drop your phone.
Yeah, cell phones
too.
And guitars. I was just thinking cell phones and guitars.
They go rice.
Yeah,
put in rice. So the rice absorbed the moisture. The guitar, the swelling went down. There were cracks all over the gold top finish, and I was like, Joe, don't change a thing.
Okay.
Seal that. Leave it all messed up looking.
Yeah.
The pickups dried out. So those are the same pickups that were basically drenched.
Yeah.
And the guitar became, you know, he got it back to life for me. And I...
You learn something new every day. That's really cool.
I kind of have this almost superstitious feeling that it sounds better, you know.
Yeah.
It survived. So that guitar, I had a SG, 61 reissue, that came back to life.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a Telecaster that came back to life. But, you know, Telecaster is a plank.
Mm-hmm.
So there's it's almost like, you know, Swiss Army knife, most durable guitar of all time.
Yeah.
Those guitars I knew were going to make it. The Les Paul was the one I was really
kind of a delicate situation. Yeah.
And it made it. And so when I play with my band, the Nashville Alternators, that's kind of the main guitar I use.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm doing sessions, you know, it's one of the main two or three that I go use.
I did neglect to mention at the top of the show that that is the most, if you are fortunate enough to be in Nashville when the Alternators are playing. I was at a Tennessee Titans game and you guys were playing between play. I was like, oh my gosh, I know. It's like some of the top studio session cats and Chris, and it's great music, great cover stuff, great. It's a feel good band. I enjoy the Alternators.
Thank
if you're
you.
Ever in Nashville and you get a chance to check out the Alternators, by all means, do it. Well, this is kind of a last second question that came into my mind as we were talking, but I'm curious. You've been here since about 79, 80.
Yeah, 40 years now.
And you've seen a lot of changes with regards to just the music scene in general. Do you feel like Nashville's kind of itself up to more? Because I got a lot of friends that are like, well, I want to come to Nashville, but it's just all country music. I don't see it as all country music. There's so much happening here.
Yeah.
Where is your place? Where do you feel like your place is in the grand scheme of things with regard to just, you know, the changes of Nashville's music scene?
I was always musically restless. I never just dug one thing.
Right.
You know. I guess if I kind of go back to what's really feels rootsy to me, it's sort of like funk guitar, a la Al McKay with Earth, Wind & Fire, or Nile Rodgers, and that kind of style of rhythm playing. So it's almost back in vogue after Daft Punk came out with Get Lucky.
Oh yeah,
and a bit of Bruno Mars, a bunch of his singles. That kind of like funk style guitar with muting and just that, you know, like on. That whole kind of skank rhythm stuff is back in. That's my roots. And fusion and Jeff Beck, Tommy Bolin, John McLaughlin, Steely Dan, Demiola, all that stuff was like. But I knew that if I was going to try to have a career with longevity, I would have to dive into a lot of different things.
Yes.
So I dove into Chet Atkins. Yeah. And I dove into Albert Lee.
Mm-hmm.
And try to like, because I'm in Nashville, I'm almost going to pick up a country thing just by osmosis.
True.
Just because I'm here.
True.
And that seemed to drive a good portion of the music industry here.
Mm-hmm.
However, you know, now there's Rudy's Jazz Bar.
Like, yeah.
The town supports a jazz club.
Yeah.
They've got salsa.
Yeah.
You know, like, there's all kinds of stuff here.
Yeah.
But here's where Nashville kind of really rules the roost. It's sort of the last place on earth where people are eyeball to eyeball and cutting tracks.
True.
It just doesn't happen much in other towns.
Yeah.
This is still a place where 4 to 6 musicians get together. Here's a number chart.
Mm-hmm.
In 3 hours, we're cutting a hit single.
Yeah.
You know. And
that to me is cool because it does set us apart. It does set this music community apart from pretty much everything else around.
It used to be that way in L.A. or New York.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that other era.
Yeah.
But
post-Detroit Motown, like when Motown moved to California.
There were always pockets of...
Yes.
Detroit had a scene, Muscle Shoals, of course.
And absolutely.
Muscle Shoals is back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're back.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always kept a gut string because I had some classical training, mm-hmm. and you never... You know, I'm Spanish. They just assume I'm like this flamenco genius.
Yeah.
Well, I can fake it.
You
know.
There you go.
We want a Paco de Lucia-esque mm-hmm. kind of thing. Well, you know, I'll try my best. You know.
Yeah.
But I always keep that, and it's almost like for music like Sting
mm-hmm.
or Fragile.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
That's one of my favorites.
So
that's actually my favorite album of all time. Nothing Like the Sun.
Nothing Like the Sun.
Are you kidding me?
It's amazing.
Get real. I mean, that's just true. That's just magnum opus right there. So.
But I've got to have a banjo.
Yes.
I have a mandolin.
Yes.
I have Celtic bouzouki.
Oh, wow.
I have, there's always a guitar in Nashville, high string
mm-hmm.
tuning. So I have a Dan Electro, you know, a six-string bass for like, you know, Southwest kind of low stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've got these guitars that mm-hmm. I use only for one thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have several guitars that I use for a lot of things, but then there's just...
Yeah, you've got that one job.
For this,
yeah.
You know, this mm-hmm. is the... You're going to stay in this tuning for the rest of your life, you know.
Yeah. So what would you say... Kind of coming off of the gear thing and back to kind of like we're heading, we're starting our descent.
Mm-hmm.
But what would you say to your 25-year-old self now?
Wow!
If you could sit down with that obligatory cup of coffee,
I don't have any regrets. I mean, I might, my 25-year-old self. Just keep your ears open.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think I made too many makes back then.
Right.
I was also in good hands. You
yeah.
know, the first two artists that I really worked with and went around the world with were Michael W. Smith and Amy.
Yeah.
Be careful, because I get really teary-eyed when I think about them. But I was in the best of hands.
Yeah, you really,
really
were.
Was. They took such good care of me,
mm-hmm.
nurtured me as a musician and spiritually, and just mm-hmm. you know, I was with a really good pocket of people.
Yeah,
I don't really have very minute amount of negative experiences in all music. I've been
that's
super
cool.
fortunate. Yeah,
yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
So, do you have spare time? What do you do in your spare time? Does that exist for you?
Well, I do a lot of writing. And music is such a all-encompassing thing
mm-hmm.
that there's always something going on in my head.
Mm-hmm.
Even when I'm out, like, I'm a runner, so, but even when I'm out jogging,
mm-hmm.
There's music going on.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I don't really have a lot of other interests. Almost everything I'm into.
Something
about music.
That's so cool.
Because I'm forever a student, like I'm really, really in a place right now where I'm having the best time of my career. right now.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was 25, I was like, what am I going to do when I'm 50?
Yeah.
You know, like...
You're still doing it.
I guess I'll, yeah, and I'm, you know.
You're still doing it.
I'm still doing it.
Yeah.
And I'm hungry for it. And mm-hmm. also, I want to learn new things, mm-hmm. you know. So, mm-hmm. I'm really kind of back into sort of these jazz blues roots that I was sort of nurturing when I was in college. So, I've got a big, like I said, I've got a big event with the Belmont Big Band. And
yeah.
there's things, you know, I on my spare time, I get out a book and read. I'm trying to work on my reading.
There you go.
Learn songs. Mm-hmm. Learn some standards again.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I got away from knowing standards, and, you know, now I kind of want to, like, I want to get inside How Insensitive and some Joe Beam mm-hmm. and get inside those songs again.
Yeah.
Because I was really starting to do that, and then I started getting hired
mm-hmm.
to work out in the real world, and then right. it was like I forgot about it.
Yeah.
So now that I've got a functioning day job, which is, you know, I play for Cetera or Kenny, and then on my spare time, I'm going to chase down some of this other stuff that has been sort of latent.
Yeah.
And work on those skills, mm-hmm. you know, because I love reading.
Yeah.
Like, I love to be in a big band.
Yeah.
And where nobody, you don't know what the music is, and they just hand it to you.
Gotcha.
Here we go. 3, 4, and you're just gotta
wow.
You gotta make music out of something you've never seen.
That's bold. That is
and
so
heard.
Bold. Yeah. That's really
well.
Bold.
It just seems to be a sort of a more of a lost skill
yeah.
that I enjoy. I enjoy that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how can people keep up with you? Are you big on social media?
I am now. I took a break from it for a minute, but you know what. I'm like everybody else. I'm just on Facebook and Instagram. That's pretty much it.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
good. That's good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you know what? This has been a real treat. I'm just so thankful I got a chance to get you in here because yours is one of the more intriguing careers that I have followed even before
Thank
I was
you.
Given this assignment. So it's nice to kind of get a little musical education from you because that you seem to – education seems to be – your deal, no matter I feel like you're the kind of person that people can learn from, even when you're not trying to be a teacher. I just feel like I can learn something from you, even just sitting down in conversation. That's just kind of you're
thank
just.
You.
I am the daughter of two school teachers, so an educational vibe is kind of my MO anyway. So I like people that I can learn from, even just in conversation. Now I want to tell you that having you here has been a most blessed education. So we're going to end it with a little bit of silliness. Yes, we got my game. Take your pick. So
right.
you know how this works. So we're just gonna roll. Okay.
Right.
So here's an obvious one: Beatles or Stones.
For me, Beatles.
Yeah. Strings, tens or elevens.
Tens.
Peanut butter, smooth or chunky.
Smooth.
Amps, Fenders or Marshalls.
Oof. I got Fender.
Okay. Coffee with the works or just straight black.
Lately, black.
All right, now. Play live or in studio?
Both.
That is an acceptable answer. Toilet paper, over or under?
Over.
Okay. Are you single?
No.
Okay, I didn't know if you were married
well,
or
no,
not.
Well...
Okay, no, I was going to say, this is something that couples have to work out on their own. Where does you have to understand, I've only been married for a year and a half, so I've been single for so long, I did not realize that how you put the toilet paper is an actual issue for people. So that's why I'm asking.
I should clarify, technically I'm single.
You're spoken for.
Yes, correct.
You're spoken for.
Let me clarify. Yeah.
All right, 4 a.m., get up or go to bed?
Well, there's a lot of 4 a.m. waking up,
mm-hmm.
and there's a Epiphone 335 by my bed. So a lot of times at 4 a.m., if it's that restless thing,
mm-hmm.
I'll pick up that guitar.
That's cool.
And work on something.
That's awesome.
Until I get tired and fall asleep.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Stevie Ray Vaughan or Bonnie Raitt?
That's such a fine line. I'll go Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Okay.
Yeah.
Chocolate or vanilla?
Chocolate.
Batman or Superman?
Batman.
Smoke on the Water or Purple Haze?
Smoke on the Water.
Ladies and gentlemen, Chris Rodriguez, thank you so much for being a part of our little program.
Thank you, Marcia, and thank you, NashvilleGuitarStore.com.
Dedicated to bringing you inspiration, education, and behind-the-scenes stories from prominent guitarists and others influential in the music profession. To hear more, subscribe to the Nashville Guitar Store podcast in iTunes. Go to NashvilleGuitarStore.com or find us on Facebook and Instagram.